He heard the distant clock strike three. Tonight, the streets would explode. According to the history books, it would be one shot that did it around sunset. One of the foot regiments would be assembled in Hen and Chicken's field awaiting orders, and there would be people watching them. Troops always drew an audience, impressionable kids, the inevitable Ankh-Morpork floating street crowd, and, of course, the ladies whose affection was extremely negotiable. The crowd shouldn't have been there, people said afterwards, but where should they have been? The field was a popular spot. It was the only vaguely green space in that part of the city. People played games there, and, of course, there was always the progress of the corpse on the gibbet to inspect. Besides, there were troops, ordinary foot soldiers, people's sons and husbands, taking a bit of a rest and having a drink. Oh, that was right. Afterwards, it was said that the troops were drunk, and that they shouldn't have been there. Yep, that was the reason, Vimes reflected. No one should have been there. But they were, and when that captain got an arrow in his stomach and was groaning on the ground, some of the crossbowmen fired in the direction of the shot. That's what the history book said. They fired at the house windows where people had been watching. Perhaps the shot had come from one of them. Some arrows fell short, some did not, and there were people who fired back. And then, one after another, horrible things would happen. By then it was too late for them not to. The tension would unwind like a spring, scything through the city. There were plotters. There was no doubt about that. Some had been ordinary people who'd had enough. Some were young people with no money who'd objected to the fact that the world was run by old people who were rich. Some were in it to get girls, and some had been idiots as mad as swing, with a view of the world just as rigid and unreal, who are on the side of what they called the people. Vimes had spent his life on the streets, and had met decent men and fools and people who'd steal a penny from a blind beggar, and people who'd performed silent miracles or desperate crimes every day behind the grubby windows of little houses, but he'd never met the people. People on the side of the people always ended up disappointed in any case. They found that the people tended not to be grateful or appreciative or forward-thinking or obedient. The people tended to be small-minded and conservative and not very clever, and were even distrustful of cleverness. And so the children of the revolution were faced with the age-old problem. It wasn't that you had the wrong kind of government, which was obvious, but that you had the wrong kind of people. As soon as you saw people as things to be measured, they didn't measure up. What would run through the streets soon enough wouldn't be a revolution or a riot. It'd be people who were frightened and panicking. It was what happened when the machinery of city life faltered, the wheels stopped turning, and all the little rules broke down. And when that happened, humans were worse than sheep. Sheep just ran. They didn't try to bite the sheep next to them. By sunset, a uniform would automatically be a target. Then it wouldn't matter where a watchman's sympathies lay. He'd be just another man in armour. "What?" he said, snapping back to the present. "You're right, Sarge," said Corporal Colon. "Hm?" said Vimes as the real world returned. "You were well away," said Fred, "staring at nothing. You ought to have had a proper sleep last night, Sarge." "There's plenty of time to sleep in the grave," Vimes said, looking at the ranks of the watch. "Yeah, I heard that, Sarge, but no one wakes you up with a cup of tea. I got them lined up, Sarge." Fred had made an effort, Vimes could see. So had the men themselves. He'd never seen them looking quite so formal. Usually they had a helmet and a breastplate apiece. Beyond that, equipment was varied and optional, but today, at least, they looked neat. Shame about the heights. No man could easily inspect a row that included Wiglet at one end and Nancy Ball at the other. Wiglet was so short that he'd once been accused of navelling a sergeant, being far too short to eyeball anyone, while Nancy Ball was always the first man on duty to know when it was raining. You had to stand well back to get both of them into vision without eye strain. "Well done, lads," he managed, and heard Rust coming down the stairs. It must have been the first time the man had seen his new command in full. In the circumstances, he bore up quite well. He merely sighed. He turned to Vimes and said, "I require something to stand on." Vimes looked blank. "Sir?" "I wish to address the men in order to inspire them and stiffen their resolve. They must understand the political background to the current crisis." "Oh, we know all about Lord Winder being a loony, sir," said Wiglet cheerfully. Frost nearly formed on Rust's forehead. Vimes drew himself up. "Squad dismiss," he shouted, and then leaned towards Rust as the men scuttled away. "A quiet word, sir." "Did that man really say—" Rust began. "Yes, sir." "These are simple men, sir," said Vimes, thinking quickly. "Best not to disturb them, if you take my meaning." Rust inserted this into his range of options. Vimes could see him thinking. It was a way out, and it suited his opinion of the watch in general. It meant that he hadn't been cheeked by a constable. He'd merely dealt with a simpleton. "They know their duty, sir," Vimes added for reinforcement.
"Their duty, sergeant, is to do what they're told."
"Exactly, sir." Rust stroked his moustache.
"There is something in what you say, sergeant. And you trust them?
As a matter of fact, sir, yes.
We will make a circuit of the surrounding streets in 10 minutes. This is a time for action. Reports are disturbing. We must hold the line, Sergeant.
And he believes it, thought Vimes. He really does. The watchmen marched out into the afternoon sunshine, and did so badly. They were not used to marching. Their normal method of progress was the stroll, which is not a recognised military manoeuvre, or the frantic withdrawal, which is. In addition, the convection currents of prudent cowardice were operating in the ranks. There was a definite sideways component to each man's progress, as he sought to be in the middle. The watchmen had shields, but they were light wickerwork things intended to turn blows and deflect stones. They wouldn't stand up to anything with an edge. The advance, therefore, was by means of a slowly elongating huddle. Rust didn't notice. He had a gift for not seeing things he did not want to see, and not hearing things he did not want to hear. And what he saw was a barricade. Ankh Morpork wasn't really a city, not when the chips were down. Places like Dolly Sisters and Knapp Hill and Seven Sleepers had been villages once, before they were absorbed by the urban sprawl. On some level, they still held themselves separate. As for the rest, well, once you got off the main streets, it was all down to neighbourhoods. People didn't move around much. When tension was high, you relied on your mates and your family. Whatever was going down, you tried to make sure it wasn't going down your street. It wasn't revolution. It was quite the reverse. It was defending your doorstep. They were building a barricade in Whalebone Lane. It wasn't a particularly good one, made up mostly of overturned market stalls, a small cart, and quite a lot of household furniture, but it was a symbol. Rust's moustache bristled.
"Right in our faces," he snapped. "Absolute defiance of constituted authority, Sergeant. Do your duty."
"And what would that be at this point, sir?" said Vimes.
"Arrest the ringleaders, and your men will pull the barricade down."
Vimes sighed. "Very well, sir. If you will stand back, I shall seek them out." He walked up to the domestic clutter, aware of eyes watching him before and behind. When he was a few feet away, he cupped his hands.
All right, what's going on here?" he shouted.
He was aware of whispering, and he was ready for what happened next. When the stone flew over the top of the furniture, he caught it in both hands.
"I asked a civil question," he said. "Come on."
There was more whispering. He distinctly heard,
"That's the sergeant from last night,"
and some sort of sotto voce argument. Then a voice shouted,
"Death to the fascist oppressors!"
This time the argument was more frantic. He heard someone say, "Oh, all right," and then,
"Death to the fascist oppressors, present company accepted. There, is everyone happy now?"
He knew that voice.
"Mr. Reginald Shue, is it?" "I regret that I have only one life to lay down for Whalebone Lane," the voice shouted from somewhere behind a wardrobe.
"If only you knew," Vimes thought.
"I don't think that'll be necessary," he said. "Come on, ladies and gentlemen. Is this the only way to behave? You can't take the law into your own hands."
His voice faltered. Sometimes it takes the brain a little while to catch up with the mouth. Vimes turned and looked at the squad, who'd needed no prompting at all to hang back, and then he turned to look at the barricade. Where exactly was the law right now? What did he think he was doing? The job, of course, the one that's in front of you. He'd always done it, and the law had always been out there, but somewhere close. He'd always been pretty sure where it was, and it definitely had something to do with the badge. The badge was important. Yes, it was shield-shaped, for protection. He'd thought about that in the long nights in the darkness. It protected him from the beast, because the beast was waiting in the darkness of his head. He'd killed werewolves with his bare hands. He'd been mad with terror at the time, but the beast had been there inside, giving him strength. Who knew what evil lurked in the hearts of men? A copper, that's who. After 10 years, you thought you'd seen it all, but the shadows always dished up more. You saw how close men lived to the beast. You realised that people like Carcer were not mad. They were incredibly sane. They were simply men without a shield. They'd looked at the world and realised that all the rules didn't have to apply to them, not if they didn't want them to. They weren't fooled by all the little stories. They shook hands with the beast. But he, Sam Vimes, had stuck by the badge, except for that time when even that hadn't been enough and he'd stuck by the bottle instead. He felt as if he'd stuck by the bottle now. The world was spinning. Where was the law? There was a barricade. Who was it protecting? From what?
The city was run by a madman and his shadowy chum, so where was the law?
Coppers liked to say that people shouldn't take the law into their own hands, and they thought they knew what they meant. But they were thinking about peaceful times, and men who went around to sort a neighbour out with a club because his dog had crapped once too often on their doorstep. But at times like this, who did the law belong to? If it shouldn't be in the hands of the people, where the hell should it be? People who knew better? And then you got Winder and his pals, and how good was that? What was supposed to happen next? Oh yes, he had a badge, but it wasn't his, not really. And he'd got orders, and they were the wrong ones. And he'd got enemies for all the wrong reasons, and maybe there was no future. It didn't exist anymore. There was nothing real, no solid point on which to stand, just Sam Vimes where he had no right to be. It was as if his body, trying to devote as many resources as possible to untangling the spinning thoughts, was drawing those resources from the rest of Vimes. His vision darkened, his knees were weak. There was nothing but bewildered despair, and a lot of explosions. Havelock Vetinari knocked politely on the window of the little office just inside the Assassin's Guild main gate. The duty porter raised the hatch.
"Signing out, Mr. Maroon," said the assassin.
"Yes, sir," said Maroon, pushing a middle lecture towards him. "And where are we off to today, sir?"
"General reconnoitring, Mr. Maroon, just generally looking around."
"Ah, I said to Mrs. Maroon last night, sir, that you are a great one for looking around," said Mr. Maroon.
"We look and learn, Mr. Maroon, we look and learn," said Vetinari, signing his name in the book and putting the pen back in its holder. "And how is your little boy?"
"Thank you for asking, sir. He's a lot better," said the porter.
"Glad to hear it. Though I see the Honourable John Bleedwell is out on the commission." "To the palace?"
"Now, now, sir," said Maroon, grinning and waving a finger. "You know I couldn't tell you that, sir, even if I knew."
"Of course not." Vetinari glanced at the back wall of the office, where, in an old brass rack, were a number of envelopes. The word "active" was inscribed at the top of the rack. "Good afternoon, Mr. Maroon."
"Afternoon, sir. Good, looking around."
He watched the young man walk out into the street. Then Maroon went into the cubbyhole next to the office and put the kettle on. He rather liked young Vetinari, who was quiet and studious, and, it had to be said, a generous young man on appropriate occasions. But a bit weird, all the same. Once Maroon had watched him in the foyer, standing still. That was all he was doing. He wasn't making any attempt at concealing himself. After half an hour, Maroon had wandered over and said,
"Can I help you, sir?"
And Vetinari had said, "Thank you, no, Mr. Maroon. I'm just teaching myself to stand still." To which there wasn't really any sensible comment that could be made. And the young man must have left after a while because Maroon didn't remember seeing him again that day. He heard a creak from the office and poked his head around the door. There was no one there. As he made the tea, he thought he heard a rustle from next door and went to check. It was completely empty. Remarkably so, he thought later on. It was almost as if it was even more empty than it would be if there was just, well, no one in it. He went back to his comfy armchair in the cubbyhole and relaxed. In the brass rack, the envelope marked Bleedwell J slid back slightly. There were a lot of explosions. The firecrackers bounced all over the street, tambourines thudded, a horn blared, a chord unknown in nature, and a line of monks danced and twirled around the corner, all chanting at the tops of their voices. Vimes, sagging to his knees, was aware of dozens of sandaled feet gyrating past and grubby robes flying. Rust was yelling something at the dancers, who grinned and waved their hands in the air. Something square and silvery landed in the dirt, and the monks were gone, dancing into an alleyway, yelling and spinning and banging their gongs.
"Wretched heathens!" said Rust, striding forward. "Have you been hit, Sergeant?"
Vimes reached down and picked up the silver rectangle. A stone clanged off Rust's breastplate. As he raised his megaphone, a cabbage hit him in the ear. Vimes stared at the thing in his hand. It was a cigar case, slim and slightly curved. He fumbled it open and read, "To Sam, with love from your Sibyl." The world moved, but now Vimes felt like a ship, drifting at anchor. At the end of the tether there was the tug of the anchor, pulling it around so that it faced the current. A barrage of missiles was coming over the barricade. Throwing things was an old Ankh-Morpork custom, and there was something about Rust that made him a target. With what dignity he could muster, he raised the megaphone again and got as far as, "I hereby warn you," before a stone spun it out of his hand.
"Very well, then," he said, and marched stiffly back to the squad. "Sergeant Keel, order the men to fire one round of arrows over the top of the barricade."
"No," said Vimes, standing up.
"I can only assume you've been stunned, Sergeant," said Rust. "Men, prepare to execute that order."
"First man that fires, I will personally cut that man down," said Vimes.
He didn't shout. It was a simple, confident statement of precisely what the future would hold. Rust's expression did not change. He looked Vimes up and down.
"Is this mutiny, then, Sergeant?" said the captain.
"No. I'm not a soldier, sir. I can't mutiny."
"Martial law, Sergeant," snapped Rust. "It is official."
"Really," said Vimes, as another rain of rocks and old vegetables came down.
"Shields up, lads."
Rust turned to Fred Colon.
"Corporal, you'll put this man under arrest."
Colon swallowed.
"Me?"
"You, Corporal, now."
Colon's pink face mottled with white as the blood drained from it.
"But he..."
he began.
"You won't? Then it seems I must," said the captain.
He drew his sword. At that, Vimes heard the click of a crossbow safety catch going off and groaned. He didn't remember this happening.
"You just put that sword away, sir, please," said the voice of Lance Constable Vimes.
"You will not shoot me, you young idiot. That would be murder," said the captain calmly.
"Not where I'm aiming, sir."
"Bloody hell," thought Vimes. Maybe the lad was simple, because one thing Rust wasn't was a coward. He thought idiot stubbornness was bravery. He wouldn't back down in the face of a dozen armed men.
"Ah, I think I can see the problem, Captain," Vimes said brightly. "As you were, Lance Constable, there's been a slight misunderstanding, sir, but this should sort it out."
It was a blow he'd remember for a long time. It was sweet. It was textbook. Rust went down like a log. In the light of all his burning bridges, Vimes slipped his hand back into his hip pocket. "Thank you, Mrs. Goodbody, and your range of little equalizers." He turned to the watchmen, who were a tableau of silent horror.
"Let the record show Sergeant-at-Arms John Keel did that," he said. "Vimes, what did I tell you about waving weapons around when you're not going to use them?"
"You laid him out, Sarge,"
Sam squeaked, still staring at the sleeping captain. Vimes shook some life back into his hand.
"Let the record show that I took command after the captain's sudden attack of insanity," he said. "Waddy, Wiglet, drag him back to the house and lock him up, will you?"
"What are we going to do, Sarge?"
wailed Colon.
"Ah.
Keep the peace. That was the thing. People often fail to understand what that meant. You'd go to some life-threatening disturbance, like a couple of neighbours scrapping in the street over who owned the hedge between their properties, and they'd both be bursting with aggrieved self-righteousness, both yelling. Their wives would either be having a private scrap on the side or would have adjourned to a kitchen for a shared pot of tea and a chat, and they all expected you to sort it out. And they could never understand that it wasn't your job. Sorting it out was a job for a good surveyor and a couple of lawyers, maybe. Your job was to quell the impulse to bang their stupid fat heads together, to ignore the affronted speeches of dodgy self-justification, to get them to stop shouting and to get them off the street. Once that had been achieved, your job was over. You weren't some walking god dispensing finely tuned natural justice. Your job was simply to bring back peace. Of course, if your few strict words didn't work, and Mr. Smith subsequently clambered over the disputed fence and stabbed Mr. Jones to death with a pair of gardening shears, then you had a different job, sorting out the notorious hedge argument murder. But at least it was one you were trained to do. People expected all kinds of things from coppers, but there was one thing that sooner or later they all wanted. Make this not be happening. Make this not be happening.
"What?"
he said, suddenly noticing a voice that had in fact been on the edge of awareness for some time.
"I said, was he insane, Sarge?"
But when you're falling off the cliff, it's too late to wonder if there might have been a better way up the mountain.
"He asked you to shoot the people who weren't shooting back," growled Vimes, striding forwards. "That makes him insane, wouldn't you say?"
"They are throwing stones, Sarge," said Colon.
"So? Stay out of range. They'll get tired before we do."
In fact, the barrage of missiles from the barricade had ceased. Even in a time of crisis, the people of Ankh Morpork would stop for a decent piece of street theatre. Vimes walked back towards them, stopping on the way to retrieve Rust's bent megaphone. As he approached, he cast his eye over faces just visible through the chair legs and junk. There would be unmentionable somewhere, he knew, helping matters along. With luck, they wouldn't have bothered with Whalebone Lane. There was muttering from the defenders.
Most of them had a look Vimes recognised, because it was the one he was trying to keep off his own face. It was the look of people whose world had suddenly been swept from under them, and now they were trying to tap-dance on quicksand. He tossed away the stupid, pompous megaphone. He cupped his hands.
"Some of you know me," he shouted. "I'm Sergeant Keel, currently in command of the Treacle Mine Road Watch House, and I order you to dismantle this barricade."
There was a chorus of jeers and one or two badly thrown missiles. Vimes waited stock still until they died away. Then he raised his hands again.
"I repeat, I order you to dismantle this barricade,"
he took a breath and went on,
"and rebuild it on the other side on the corner with Cable Street, and put up another one at the top of Shear Street, properly built. Good grief, you don't just pile stuff up for God's sake. A barricade is something you construct. Who's in charge here?"
There were sounds of consternation behind the overturned furniture, but a voice called out,
"You?"
There was nervous laughter.
"Very funny. Now laugh this one off. No one's interested in us yet. This is a quiet part of town. But when things really go bad, you're going to have cavalry on your backs, with sabres. How long would you last? But if you shut off this end of Treacle Mine and the end of Shear, then they're left with alleyways, and they don't like that. It's up to you, of course. We'd like to protect you, but me and my men will be behind the barricades over here."
He turned on his heel and marched back to the waiting watchman.
"Right, lads," he said. "You heard. Pounce and Gaskin, you take the hurry-up wagon up to the bridge and turn it over. Waddy and Nancy Ball, you too, Fred, go and nick some carts. You grew up round here, so don't tell me you've never done that before. I want a couple blocking the streets down here, and the rest, I want you to run them into an alley mouths until they wedge. You men know the area. Block up all the little backways."
Colon rubbed his nose.
"We could do that on the riverside, Sarge, but it's all alleys on the shade side. Can't block them all."
"I wouldn't worry about those," said Vimes. "Cavalry can't come through there. You know what they call a horse in the shades?"
Colon grinned.
"Yes, Sarge, lunch."
"Right. The rest of you, get all the benches and tables out of the watch house."
It dawned on him that none of the men had moved. There was a certain problem in the air.
"Well?"
Billy Wiglet removed his helmet and wiped his forehead.
How far is this going to go, Sarge?"
"All the way, Billy."
"But we took the oath, Sarge. And now we're disobeying orders and helping rebels. Doesn't seem right, Sarge,"
said Wiglet wretchedly.
"You took an oath to uphold the law and defend the citizens without fear or favour," said Vimes, "and to protect the innocent. That's all they put in. Maybe they thought those were the important things. Nothing in there about orders, even from me. You're an officer of the law, not a soldier of the government."
One or two of the men looked longingly at the other end of the street, empty and inviting.
"But I won't stop anyone who wants to walk," said Vimes.
They stopped looking.
"Hello, Mr. Keel," said a sticky voice behind him.
"Yes, Nobby," he said without turning round.
"Here, how'd you detect it was me, Sergeant?"
"It's an amazing talent, kid," said Vimes, turning, against all wisdom, to look at the urchin. "What's been happening?"
"Big riot in St. Ors Square, Sarge. They say people have broken into Dolly Sister's watch house and thrown the lieutenant out the window. And there's looting all over the place, they say, and the day watch are out chasing people, only most of them are hiding now, because—"
"Yeah, I get the picture," sighed Vimes. Carser had been right. Coppers were always outnumbered, so being a copper only worked when people let it work. If they refocused and realised you were just another standard idiot with a penny worth of metal for a badge, you could end up a smear on the pavement.
He could hear shouting now, a long way off. He looked around at the hesitant watchman.
"On the other hand, gentlemen," he said, "if you are going to leave, where are you going to go to?"
The same thought had clearly occurred to Colon and the others.
"We'll get the cots," he said, hurrying off. "And I want a penny," said Nobby, holding out a grubby hand.
To the boy's amazement, Vimes gave him a dollar, saying,
"And just keep telling me everything, will you?"
Tables and benches were already being dragged out of the watch house, and after only a couple of minutes, Waddy arrived with a cartload of empty barrels. Barricades were easy in these streets. It was keeping them clear that had always been the problem. The watchmen set to work. This was something they understood. They'd done it when they were kids, and perhaps they thought, hey, this time we're wearing uniforms. We can't be in the wrong. While Vimes was struggling to wedge a bench into the growing wall, he was aware of people behind him. He worked steadily, however, until someone gave a delicate cough. Then he turned.
"Yes, can I help you?"
There was a small group of people, and it was clear to Vimes that it was a group pushed together out of shared terror, because by the look of them, they'd have nothing to do with one another if they could possibly avoid it. The spokesman, or at least the one in front, looked almost exactly like the kind of person Vimes had pictured when thinking about the hedge argument murder.
Officer?
Yes, sir.
What, are you doing exactly?
Keeping the peace, sir. This peace, to be exact.
You say that there's rioting and soldiers on the way?
Very likely, sir.
You don't have to ask him, Rutherford. It's his duty to protect us, snapped the woman who was standing beside the man with an air of proprietorship.
Vimes changed his mind about the man. Yes, he had that furtive look of a timid domestic poisoner about him, the kind of man who'd be appalled at the idea of divorce, but would plot woman's slaughter every day. And you could see why. He gave the lady a nice warm smile. She was holding a blue vase.
"Can I help you, ma'am?" he said.
"What are you intending to do about us being murdered in our beds?" she demanded.
"Well, it's not 4 o'clock yet, ma'am, but if you'll let me know when you want to retire..."
Vimes was impressed at the way the woman drew herself up. Even Sybil, in full Duchess mode, with the blood of 20 generations of arrogant ancestors behind her, could not have matched her.
"Rutherford, are you going to do something about this man?" she said.
Rutherford looked up at Vimes. Vimes was aware that he was villainously unshaven, dishevelled, dirty, and probably starting to smell. He decided not to load more troubles on the man's back.
"Would you and your lady care to assist with our barricade?" he said.
"Oh, yes, thank you, very," Rutherford began, but was outgunned again.
"Some of that furniture looks very dirty," said Mrs. Rutherford. "And aren't those beer barrels?"
"Yes, ma'am, but they're empty ones," said Vimes.
"Are you sure? I refuse to cower behind alcohol. I have never approved of alcohol, and neither has Rutherford."
"I can assure you, ma'am, that any beer barrel in the presence of my men for any length of time will be empty," said Vimes. "You may rest assured on that score."
"And are your men sober and clean living?" the woman demanded.
"Whenever no alternative presents itself, ma'am," said Vimes.
This seemed acceptable. Mrs. Rutherford was like rust in that respect. She listened to the tone of voice, not the words.
"I think perhaps it would be a good idea, dear, if we made a haste to..." Rutherford began.
"Not without father," said his wife.
"No problem, ma'am," said Vimes. "Where is he?"
"On our barricade, of course, which was, let me tell you, a rather better barricade altogether."
"Jolly good, ma'am," said Vimes. "If he'd like to come over here, we'll..."
"You don't quite understand, sir," murmured Rutherford. "He is, on the barricade." Vimes looked at the other barricade and then looked harder. It was just possible to see, near the top of the piled-up furniture, an overstuffed armchair. Further examination suggested that it was occupied by a sleeping figure in carpet slippers.
"He's very attached to his armchair," sighed Rutherford.
"It's going to be an heirloom," said his wife. "Be so kind as to send your young men to collect our furniture, will you? And be careful with it. Put it at the back somewhere where it won't get shot at."
Vimes nodded at Sam and a couple of the other men as Mrs. Rutherford picked her way over the debris and headed for the watch house.
"Is there going to be any fighting?" said Mr. Rutherford anxiously.
"Possibly, sir.
I'm not very good at that sort of thing, I'm afraid."
"Don't worry about that, sir."
Vimes propelled the man over the barricade and turned to the rest of the little group. He'd been aware of eyes boring into him, and now he traced the rays back to source, a young man with black trousers, a frilly shirt, and long hair.
"This is a ruse, isn't it?" said the man. "You'll get us in your power and we'll never be seen again, eh?"
"Stay out then, Reg," said Vimes.
He cupped his hands and turned back to the Whalebone Lane barricade.
"Anyone else who wants to join us had better get a move on," he shouted.
"You don't know that's my name," said Reg Shue.
Vimes stared into the big protruding eyes. The only difference between Reg now and the Reg he'd left back in the future was that Constable Shue was rather greyer and was held together in places by stitches. Zombiehood would come naturally to Reg. He was born to be dead. He believed so strongly in things that some kind of inner spring kept him going. He'd make a good copper. He didn't make a very good revolutionary. People as meticulously fervent as Reg got real revolutionaries worried. It was the way he stared.
"You're Reg Shue," he said. "You live in Whalebone Lane."
"Oh, you've got secret files on me, they," said Reg with terrifying happiness.
"Not really, no. Now, if you'd be so good..."
"I'll bet you've got a big file on me a mile long," said Reg.
"Not a whole mile, Reg, no," said Vimes.
"Listen, Reg, I demand to see it."
Vimes sighed.
"Mr. Shue, we don't have a file on you. We don't have a file on anyone, understand? Half of us can't read without using a finger. Reg, we are not interested in you."
Reg Shue's slightly worrying eyes remained fixed on Vimes's face for a moment, and then his brain rejected the information as contrary to whatever total fantasy was going on inside.
"Well, it's no good you torturing me, because I won't reveal any details about my comrades in the other revolutionary cells," said Reg.
"OK, I won't then. Now, perhaps
That's how we work, see? None of the cadres knows about the other ones.
Really? Do they know about you? Said Vimes. For a moment, Reggie's face clouded.
Pardon?
Well, you said you don't know about them, said Vimes. So, do they know about you?
He wanted to add, you're a cell of one, Reg. The real revolutionaries are silent men with poker player eyes and probably don't know or care if you exist. You've got the shirt and the haircut and the sash, and you know all the songs, but you're no urban guerrilla. You're an urban dreamer. You turn over rubbish bins and scrawl on walls in the name of the people who'd clip you round the ear if they found you doing it. Would you believe?
Ah, so you're a secret operative, he said, to get the poor man off the hook.
Reg brightened.
That's right, he said. The people are the sea in which the revolutionary swims.
Like swordfishes, Vimes tried.
Pardon?
And you're a flounder, thought Vimes.
Ned's a revolutionary. He knows how to fight and he can think, even if he is on the skew. But, Reg, you really ought to be indoors.
Well, I can see you're a dangerous individual, he said. We'd better have you where we can keep an eye on you.
Hey, that's right. You can undermine the enemy from within.
The relieved Reg raised a fist in salute and carried a table to the new barricade with revolutionary speed. There was some hurried conversation behind the old makeshift barricade, already being denuded of Mrs. Rutherford's furniture. This was interrupted by the clatter of hoofbeats from the far Treacle Mine Road and a sudden burst of instant decisiveness on the part of the remainder of the crowd. They poured towards the new official barricade, with Lance Constable Vimes bringing up the rear, fairly well hampered by a dining-room chair.
"Mind out for that!" shouted a female voice from somewhere behind him. "It's one of a set!"
Vimes put his hand on the young man's shoulder. "Just give me your crossbow, will you?" he said. The horseman came closer. Sam Vimes was not good at horses. Something in him resented being addressed by anyone 8 feet above the ground. He didn't like the sensation of being looked at by nostrils. He didn't like being talked down to. By the time they'd reached the barricade, he'd clambered around to the front of it and was standing in the middle of the street. They slowed down. It was probably the way he didn't move, but held the crossbow in the nonchalant manner of someone who knows how to use it, but has decided not to for the moment.
"You there," said a trooper.
"Yeah," said Vimes.
"Are you in charge?"
"Yeah, can I help you?"
"Where are your men?"
Vimes jerked a thumb towards the growing barricade. On the top of the heap, Mrs. Rutherford's father was snoring peacefully.
"Well, that's a barricade," said the trooper.
"Well done.
There's a man waving a flag."
Vimes turned. Surprisingly, it was Reg. Some of the men had brought out the old flag from Tilden's office and stuck it on the barricade, and Reg was the sort to wave any flag going.
"Probably high spirits, sir," said Vimes. "Don't worry, we're all fine."
"It's a damn barricade, man, a rebel barricade,"
said the second trooper. "Oh, boy," thought Vimes. "They have shiny, shiny breastplates and wonderfully fresh pink faces."
"Not exactly. It's you, stupid fellow. Don't you know that all barricades are to be torn down by order of the patrician?"
The third horseman, who had been staring at Vimes, urged his horse a little closer.
"What's that pip on your shoulder, officer?" he said.
"Means I'm sergeant-at-arms, special rank. And who are you?" "He doesn't have to tell you that," said the first trooper.
"Really?" said Vimes.
The man was getting on his nerves.
"Well, you're just a trooper, and I'm a bleeding sergeant, and if you dare to speak to me like that again, I'll have you down off that horse and thump you across the ear. Understand?"
Even the horse took a step backwards. The trooper opened his mouth to speak, but the third horseman raised a white-gloved hand.
"Oh, dear," thought Vimes, focusing on the sleeve of the red jacket. The man was a captain. Not only that, he was an intelligent one by the look of him. He hadn't mouthed off until he had a chance to assess the situation. You got them sometimes, they could be dangerously bright.
"I note, Sergeant at Arms," said the captain, enunciating the rank with care and without apparent sarcasm, "that the flag over the barricade is the flag of Ankh-Morpork."
"It's the one of our watchhouse," said Vimes, and added, "Sir,
you know that the patrician has declared that the building of barricades is an act of rebellion?"
"Yes, sir."
"And?" said the captain patiently.
"Well, he would say that, sir, wouldn't he?"
The faintest hint of a smile skimmed across the captain's face.
"We can't allow lawlessness, sergeant-at-arms. If we all disobeyed the law, where would we be?"
"There's more coppers per person behind that barricade than anywhere else in the city, sir," said Vimes. "You could say it's the most law-abiding place around."
Now there was the sound of raised voices from behind the barricade. "We own all your helmets, we own all your shoes, we own all your generals, touch us and you'll lose. More porkia, more porkia, more porkia."
"Rebel song, sir," said Trooper Number One.
The captain sighed.
"If you listen, Heppelwhite, you might note that it is the national anthem sung very badly," he said.
"We can't allow rebels to sing that, sir."
Vimes saw the captain's expression. It had a lot to say about idiots.
"Raising the flag and singing the anthem, Heppelwhite, are, while somewhat suspicious, not in themselves acts of treason," said the captain, "and we are urgently required elsewhere."
He saluted Vimes, who found himself returning the salute.
"We shall leave you, Sergeant, at arms. I trust your day will be full of interest. In fact, I know it."
"But it's a barricade, sir," the trooper insisted, glaring at Vimes.
"It's just a pile of furniture, man. People have been spring-cleaning, I expect. You'll never be an officer if you can't see straight. Follow me, if you please."
With a last nod to Vimes, the captain led his men away at a trot. Vimes leaned against the barricade, put the crossbow on the ground, and fished out the cigar case. He fumbled in his pocket, pulled out the battered carton of little cigars, and, with some delicacy, slotted them into place. To the left was Cable Street. In front, Treacle Mine Road stretched all the way to Easy Street. Now, if a man could get barricades all the way up to Easy Street, there'd be quite a slice of the lower hub side behind it, which would be a lot easier to protect. We'll do it. After all, we did it. Of course, that'd mean having the Unmentionables' headquarters in here with us. That's like pitching your tent over a nest of vipers. We'll handle that. We handled it. A couple of elderly people pushing a cart full of miscellaneous belongings approached the barricade. They gave Vimes a look of mute pleading. He nodded towards it and they scuttled through. "All we need now is
Sarge."
Fred Colon was leaning over the top of the heap. He looked more out of breath than usual.
"Yes, Fred. There's lots of people coming across the Ponds Bridge. There's things happening everywhere, they say. Shall we let them in?"
"Any soldiers?"
"I don't reckon so, Sarge. It's mostly old people and kids, and my granny."
"Trustworthy?"
"Not when she's had a few pints."
"Let them in, then."
Said Colon.
"Yes, Fred."
"Some of them is watchmen. A few of the lads from Dimwell and a lot from Kingsway. I know most of them, and those I don't know are known to the ones I do, if you catch my meaning."
"How many?"
"About 20. One of them's Di Dickens, sergeant at Dimwell. He says they were told they'd got to shoot people, and most of them deserted on the spot."
"Quit, Fred," said Vimes. "We don't desert, we're civilians. Now I want young Vimes and you and Waddy and maybe half a dozen others out here fully kitted up in 2 minutes, understand? And tell Wiglet to organise squads ready to move the barricades forward at my signal."
"Move them, Sarge. I thought barricades stood still."
"And tell Snout he's got 2 minutes to find me a bottle of brandy," said Vimes, ignoring this. "A big one."
"Are we taking the law into our own hands again, Sarge?" said Colon.
Vimes stared at the entrance to Cable Street and was aware of the weight of the cigar case in his pocket.
"Yes, Fred. Only this time we are going to squeeze."